With great power comes great responsibility.
Compromise where you can. Where you can't, don't. Even if everyone is telling you that something wrong is something right, even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye and say no, you move.
Never step onto the battlefield of ideas unprepared. Before you enter the fray, you need a plan. And there's no better place to get one than right here on Tactics with host Caleb Colquitt. The Situation Room goes live now on News Radio 1440.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Situation Room here on Tactics. I am Caleb Colquitt. Thank you for joining us, whether you're joining us on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitter, or Twitch, or Periscope. However you're coming to us today, we appreciate you being here. Thank you so much for making us a part of your day right here on Tactics, where tolerance isn't love, speech isn't hatred, and disagreement also isn't hatred. One of these days, I'm going to learn my own show's motto. All right, so I've really got, you know, I've memorized 10, 12-minute long speeches, and I'm having a hard time with that one motto. But anyway, 1 Corinthians has a really fascinating side to it that was brought out in a very unexpected way for me this week. And for those of you who haven't really been paying much attention to the show, at least the makeup of it on a day-to-day basis, you'll know that on Wednesday, what we try to do with the program is, because I have church and it was becoming a hassle to where I couldn't even do a show or couldn't really get into detail on any one story, we've decided to do a very much abridged version of the show. But since it's surrounding church day anyway for most of you, I thought that it made a lot of sense to go ahead and do something sort of in a more spiritual nature. So still news, but news that has a specific twist. And I have to admit, this is an odd one. And I think that it's just a fascinating thing that even though I know that we rail against the social woes of social media, the internet, that kind of thing, and those are not without merit. Although on an unrelated story today, actually Facebook did something that's really encouraging for trying to make their platform a little bit more open and a little bit more in line with being an actual neutral forum for people to converse on. So props to them on that. We'll talk about that maybe at a later date. But we all know that social media tends to be a place where people get online and argue with one another, and they create a lot of heat, but not a whole lot of light. And part of the reason for this, part of the reason discussions typically delve into shouting matches, as much of a shouting match as can occur over a computer, a big part of that reason is because it's not personal and because people aren't willing to listen or to dive deep. It's very superficial and it stays surface level. And that's the reason you don't have a lot of those meaningful conversations you can typically have face to face or even over a phone. Even if you can't see the person's face, you can at least hear their voice. But occasionally, a really good productive conversation comes out of the internet. And this is something that was incredibly unexpected for me, because it was about one of the strangest topics I've ever tackled, yoga. There was an AL.com article, and what it went over is that it was essentially asking the question, should yoga be allowed in Alabama schools? Because for those of you who are not in the know, there actually is a law specifically banning yoga and a few other things on the books that was passed in 1993. So this law actually banned yoga from all Alabama public schools K-12. And it also bans meditation, hypnosis, guided imagery. I don't even know what the heck that is. But it bans all of those things and has been my entire life, just about it. I mean, I was born in 89, but by the time I got into the public school system in kindergarten, it would have been 1994. So the entirety of my life that I was a part of the public education system, this has been something that has been banned. Now, before we get anywhere close to having this discussion, I think at least one disclaimer is in order right now. I hate yoga. I really do. So I'm not coming at this from the perspective of somebody who really likes yoga and wants to justify it or condemn it, because I frankly just have no interest in yoga. It's not something, like I said, when I posted this article, I was just posting it because I thought it was interesting and a little strange and it's local news. I was not expecting a deep theological discussion to spring up from that, but it actually did, and I thought it was actually a lot of fun. And that's the reason that I want to bring at least a part of that to you today. But yoga, meditation, hypnosis, all banned in the state of Alabama. Now, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. I don't really like yoga. I think that it's mostly, I wouldn't say worthless, but it's not nearly as productive as a lot of other stretching and flexibility exercises that you could do. Now, I know that it has some health benefits, and full disclosure, I used to do P90X, and if you've ever done P90X, you know that one of the days that you do P90X is basically an hour-long yoga session. So I've done yoga. I've done it extensively. I've done pretty intense yoga because it was a part of P90X. I didn't like it all that much. I didn't think it was nearly as useful as the other parts of the program. But nonetheless, this was a part of it. So I'm not sure exactly why it's banned, and that was my initial reaction, and then I'll give you some of the responses and the reason that I reacted the way that I did. And hypnosis is another one that is odd that it's lumped in here, because hypnosis is just psychology. Now, there was a time where hypnosis was kind of more categorized in pseudopsychology, but it is an actual real event, and they can monitor brain activity to where a hypnotic state is a real thing. And so it kind of made that leap from pseudopsychology into real legitimate psychology, a practice that is used by doctors all the time. It isn't just gobbledygook. By the way, I've been hypnotized before. I've hypnotized other people before. It's not like it is in the movies or in video games or anything like that, but there is a legitimate psychological practice. It's even used by law enforcement now in some rare cases. But hypnosis is just, it's an interesting study. I don't know why it's specifically banned in schools either. Meditation is interesting too, because the underlying cause, the underlying rationale for this ban being in place in yoga or hypnosis is that it was viewed as something that would be religiously intolerable. In other words, there were people that their religion taught against it. Now, I don't know whose religion teaches against hypnosis. Again, that's just part of psychology. That's kind of a new one on me. But when it comes to meditation, one of the reasons that it was included in this and that it was banned is that, like yoga, its origins, it has origins and ties back to Eastern traditions and Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, that sort of thing. But the interesting thing about that is meditation does have ties to those religions for sure. And I would even say that they're greater emphasized than any other religion. In other words, meditation is something that actually spans all religions, but it seems to be more emphasized in Eastern religions. But it is not a practice that is exclusive to those religions. For example, if you're looking at any of the Abrahamic religions, which of course would be Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, there's quite a bit of references to meditation. You see this frequently in the book of Job. You see it in the Psalms talking about meditating upon God, meditating upon His word. Meditation is not something that it would be out of the norm for Christianity. Of course, things like prayer and singing, actual acts of worship are emphasized over that, and it never talks about meditation being an act of worship. But it is interesting that the rationale behind, no, we can't do meditation in public schools seems to be that it had ties back to Eastern religions, but the truth is there's not a religion that meditation isn't a part of, at least in some way. Maybe a smaller part of Christianity, but it's not against Christianity for sure. We even get indications from the Bible that Jesus would go off and meditate. Now, that was coupled with prayer for sure. But meditating upon God, meditating upon His word is not necessarily something that has its origin in any of the Eastern religions. But anyway, this whole thing snowballed and started a discussion with my friends on both sides of the issue. Both people that I respect, both people that take their faith very seriously, that were making the argument that there's nothing wrong with yoga, that you can be a devoted Christian and yoga has nothing to do with the Eastern religions. I also had Christians that, again, take their faith very seriously that were saying, no, no, we need to stay away from yoga because of its ties to those Eastern religions. Now, I didn't even know that yoga was a religious practice until this discussion cropped up. Chalk that up to my ignorance. I didn't realize that its origins actually were in the Eastern traditional religions. I didn't know that that was part of it, but apparently it is. And I don't honestly see any harm in stretching as a practice. I don't see that as being an issue as long as the spiritualism isn't integrated into that. But my friends brought up some good points, and I'd like to go through them. I'm not going through them to address them or to debunk them. I'm just going to present them and sort of give my takeaways on it. So I'd really do ask that you kind of go with me through this with an open mind, because I think there are several actually very good points brought up here. First of all, one point that I don't think is really relevant, and I'll explain why, is that, well, there are Hindus that say that you cannot separate the spiritual aspects of yoga from the physical acts of yoga. In other words, if you're doing a, what's one of the yoga stances, salute to the sun or downward dog or any of those, that you can't engage in that with separating the spirituality from it. Or at the very least, they will say, well, maybe you can separate it, but if you do, you're acting incorrectly. I don't see this as a good reason to avoid yoga, because of course the people that are actually Buddhist and Hindus and see it as a religious practice would say that. For the same reason that a Jewish person or a Muslim person would see something very spiritual in maintaining a pure diet in accordance with their religious teachings. But the truth is, a person does not have to connect their spirituality to it. For example, I don't necessarily have to see it as a spiritual thing to abstain from eating pork or eating shellfish like a Jewish person would. That's not necessarily something that I have to tie spirituality to. I can, and I might do so mistakenly, but the point is, that is not, and a Jewish person would say that, you know, you are supposed to connect that with spirituality because that's what their religion teaches. But that does not mean that a person can't just abstain from eating those things without making it an actual spiritual part, having some kind of spiritual significance behind it. And if we're going to say that, we would also have to say the same thing with certain martial arts. Now, I've never personally studied Kung Fu. The martial arts that I've studied don't have as much of a spiritual tie. Taekwondo, for example, is actually a pretty new martial art. People think of it as being ancient and everything, and it definitely has origins that stretch far back, but formalized Taekwondo actually is only about a half century old. And when you're looking at some of the other martial arts that I've studied, Bushido, it has more of a spiritual tie, but it's really much more secular than the origins of yoga. But if you're looking at Kung Fu, Kung Fu is absolutely integrated as a part of the Shaolin tradition. And it's actually seen as a religious spiritual act. And so I do think it's important to note that we are going to have to make a similar claim to Kung Fu or other martial arts if we're going to apply the same standard to yoga. So that's really where we're coming at. Now let's actually dive into some of the scripture on this. First of all, there are two main points here. One is the stumbling block point. And I encourage you to read about these yourself. We don't have time to get into all of the specifics because we're quickly running out of time. But the stumbling block argument essentially comes from 1 Corinthians 8, 1 through 13. And again, I encourage you to study this on your own. If you have to pause the video right now, want to read through that chapter, I highly, highly encourage that you do that. But essentially what is going on in 1 Corinthians 1:13 is Paul is describing a situation where you have a lot of Christians in Corinth, and it's important to note that in Corinth, it's a very Greek city. There are some Jewish Christians there, but it's primarily Gentiles that have been converted to Christianity. And because of that, you don't see nearly as much addressing the eating of unclean things or keeping the Sabbaths like you do in, for example, Galatians or Ephesians, because this was a body of believers that didn't have nearly as many Jewish Christians. And so what they're dealing with is sort of taking themselves out of that old paganistic way of thinking and trying to live as a baptized, saved person. A completely changed Christian taking out of their old worldly paganistic lifestyle and living a very different kind of life. And as you can understand, that's been a challenge for several of these Christians. And this is where 1 Corinthians 8:1 through 13 comes in. It seems as though, based on the text, that there were Christians that, because they no longer believed in idols, were actually making a show of themselves and specifically going into idolic temples and partaking in some of their rituals, including eating of meats that had been sacrificed to these various pagan idols. And they were strong in their faith, didn't believe that there was any spiritual tie to it, nothing actually wrong with it. It was almost like they were touting their own spiritual strength by saying that, oh, I can eat this meat that's sacrificed to an idol because I know idols aren't real. Are they correct in that? Yes, they absolutely are. In fact, the scripture even goes into that we know that there's no such thing as an idol. There's nothing spiritual about the meat. There's nothing that is tainted in that meat just because some pagan said that, oh, this is meat that's sacrificed to an idol. Here's what was going on, though. There were other Christians that were seeing these Christians do this, and it seemed to them as though these people were specifically engaging in religious rituals of a different religion, which is super strange. And then you also had another situation that you were dealing with, to where, and this is something that is well documented in both 1st and 2nd Corinthians, in a lot of these heavily Greek towns where you had mostly Gentiles that had converted to Christianity, they were having a real hard time leaving a lot of their paganistic ideas behind. This was something that was very common to the children of Israel. Once they started living amongst the pagans in the Middle East, over in the land of Israel and the surrounding nations from them, when they were living amongst those people, they fell into the bad habits of doing a lot of the things that the nations surrounding them did. And so just like the Israelites were having an issue separating themselves from the surrounding nations and trying not to pick up those bad habits, it seems that the church was on a smaller level going through a similar deal here at Corinth. So you had some Christians that were engaging in these rituals saying, oh, well, there's nothing to that. I'm just going there to eat, and I'm actually almost showing off how strong my faith is by saying that I can eat these things and it doesn't bother me. Then you had other Christians in the camp that I just described that they took more of the stance that the Israelites had in the Old Testament, which is, well, God is the greatest God, sure, but there's also these other gods and they're real and you can pay homage to them and pay homage to God. Just like in the Old Testament, that is not how God works. And that's what Paul is dealing with in 1 Corinthians 10, just a couple chapters later. So Israel had this bad habit of falling into idolatry. And Paul explains to them, he actually gives them a brief history of the nation of Israel and their struggles with this, which I also find interesting because this does lead to the belief that a lot of people try to say that Paul and the other apostles disregarded the Old Testament, said that it wasn't important and didn't want people to learn it. This is a group of predominantly Gentile Christians, and Paul is citing the Old Testament to them, which means what? That somebody had been teaching them the Old Testament. These are passages that they were familiar with, not because they were raised in the Jewish tradition, but because the apostles and other church leaders were teaching them the Old Testament to help better improve their understanding of the New. And so that is an important takeaway from this as well. So essentially, this is where the argument comes in, and I think that this is actually a decent argument, that we should not engage in things like yoga, we should not engage in those practices, because they could be a stumbling block to Christians around us. In other words, because we're engaging in a ritual that originated as a sort of act of worship to pagan gods, that just like Christians were told to avoid the meat for fear of causing the other Christians around them to stumble, or causing those that were non-believers to look at Christians and go, well, they live like everybody else. Why should I join their religion if they live just like the rest of us? Is there a good point in saying that, well, maybe what we ought to do is just err on the side of caution, and so we don't act as a stumbling block to those around us, whether they be Christians or non-believers, that look on us and don't see a distinction between our lifestyle and the lifestyle of non-Christians? Maybe what we ought to do is just avoid yoga altogether for fear of that coming about. I don't think that that is an argument that is without its merits. I do think, however, that A, you can absolutely separate the physical aspect and the spiritual aspect of yoga. And just like back where Paul was talking about in the passage, there's nothing inherently wrong with consuming meat that is sacrificed to an idol. The idol's not bad. In fact, he brings out in 1 Corinthians 10, he brings out the fact that if you didn't know that the meat was being sacrificed to an idol, you just eat that meat unknowingly, then you're in the clear because it's a question of conscience. It's not that the meat has now been spiritually tainted and anyone who eats that meat is now involved in some kind of sin unknowingly. That's not what Paul is saying. And he's also saying that if you're talking about going to the marketplace, buying essentially meat that was used in a sacrifice for your own consumption at home where nobody's going to see it and nobody would be around to stumble, that that is also permissible. And so because of that, I think that we can readily understand that this is not some kind of issue that is going to be brought up with evoking demons or bringing about some kind of sinful act just by means of eating the meat itself. And so that's why I don't really believe that the second example here, the second situation that Paul is dealing with in 1 Corinthians 10 would be anything that's sinful. In the same way, I don't think that if you did want to participate in yoga, to follow the biblical example here, if we're going to make that analogous to this eating of paganistic meat, that if you know that there's nothing spiritual about it, if you know that it's not something that's going to be a temptation for you, that you think about it as a purely physical exercise just used to improve your flexibility and strengthen your core or burn calories, whatever it is you're using it to do, that doing it in the privacy of your home certainly would not be an issue if we're going to make this analogous to the eating of this meat. But on the other side of it, with somebody doing a stumbling block, with somebody that is spiritually harmed by that, the question then becomes, well, if there's nothing inherently wrong with it, then how do we know that it was causing issues for Christians around them at the time? It was because of the culture that they were in and the perception of those around them. So that really brings me to my next question, because I do think that this is important. Because if there's nothing about the act itself that was tainted, just like I don't think that stretching in and of itself, there's anything wrong with that. And we actually see that in verse 26, where Paul just flat out says that there is no meat that has been created by God that is somehow spiritually tainted in 1 Corinthians 10:26. I think that if we understand that aspect of it, then the question really becomes, how do people around us perceive it? Now, there are several Christians that engage in yoga and don't think about it at all as a spiritual exercise. And keep in mind, I'm a 30-year-old person who spends quite a bit of his time studying theology and did not even realize that yoga used to be a religious practice. Now, maybe it was just a blind spot for me, but I kind of tend to think that if that's the case, then the vast overwhelming majority of the American population doesn't realize that there's anything spiritualistic to it either. Maybe I'm in the minority on that, and if so, then take that the way that you want to. if you were living in an area or in a time or culture where yoga was seen as a religious activity, and that activity was coupled with a religion other than Christianity that is in opposition to Christianity, then I would have to say, yeah, for the sake of not being a stumbling block to others, probably best not to do it. And take the stance that Paul did at the end of chapter 8, where he says, look, if it causes my brother to stumble, then I'll never eat meat again if that's what it takes. I do think there is biblical precedent for taking extremes to ensure the spiritual well-being of yourself and those around you. I don't think that that is without biblical merit. I do, however, think that we are currently living in a time in a society that does not view yoga in any kind of religious way. It has been so profoundly secularized that I think the vast overwhelming majority of the population looks at that and says, eh, there's nothing to that. And they know that if they see a person doing yoga in public, they do not assume that that person is a Hindu or a Buddhist, or that they are doing so trying to engage in some kind of New Age medicine ritual. I just don't think that that's the case. And so this is one of those occasions where I believe, and if I'm wrong, feel free to comment, get in touch with me on Twitter at Tactics Radio, email me. I'd love to have more of this discussion because, again, I enjoy the discussion. I was not expecting a deep theological discussion to come out of this one Facebook post, and it totally did. But my conclusion that I would draw is, if we were in a culture where it was common knowledge and everybody immediately assumed that if you were engaging in yoga, that you were either weak in your faith or at the very least you approved of some of the teachings of Hinduism and Taoism and Buddhism, then I would have to say, yeah, probably best to avoid it. Or at the very least, just do it in the comfort of your own home and make sure that nobody else sees it so that they might not get the wrong idea about why you're stretching out that way. But in our current culture, I just don't see it as being a big deal. I mean, to the average person, they walk by, they see a person doing yoga, they don't assume that that person is involved in some kind of paganistic ritual. And if you're like me, you didn't even know it was one. So that's just kind of my takeaway from it. I don't know that I'm 100% right. This is one where the Bible, obviously it doesn't mention yoga, so it's a little less clear, but I got to give props to my friend Justin for bringing up these passages of scripture because I thought this was a phenomenal application of it. So hopefully we'll have more discussions like this in the future. I got to get to church. In the meantime, stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.